2007, and we're here for a public hearing on Senate Bill 5515, which is the Department of Higher Education budget. Please, Mr. Staffer, let us know what we're supposed to be doing here.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. This is the third day of agency testimony on the Department of Higher Education budget, and today's testimony will be focusing on performance of the system. There are, again, we hope you have your presentation handout here. The agency has also distributed to you a copy of the slides that they will be going through today, and we urge you to look at that. They also have distributed a letter regarding tuition and co-chair's budget. I don't know if they want to spend time speaking on that now or not, but otherwise, turn it over to the agency.
I think we will just turn it over. Ms. Weeks, are you going to start out? Or?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the gentleman to my left, who is Dalton Miller-Jones, will begin the presentation.
Mr. Miller-Jones, please proceed at your convenience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dalton Miller-Jones. I'm a member of the State Board of Higher Education and a professor of psychology at Portland State University, also chair of the Department of Black Studies, Ethnic Studies. I want to thank you for the opportunity to lead off a set of presentations today that I think address a vital area of concern for the board and I think for the state. And I think I'd like to first point out that most of my comments are not available to you now, but they will be made available to you if you need to. We are in an era of accountability. It's undoubtedly apparent to everyone. It's certainly true for the last decade or more in the K-12 education system, and it is increasingly part of the climate of higher education. Whether you're looking at data reported by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education's Measuring Up, a kind of report card on higher education across the states, or to Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings' commission report calling for the introduction of performance student learning outcomes in higher ed, or the use of student learning outcomes by the major higher education accreditation organizations, for example, the Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges, the Midwest Association of Colleges and Universities. We are all being asked to demonstrate what our students know and can do, as well as to measure many aspects of institutional performance. Last week, Chair of the Board of Higher Education, Henry Lorenzen, spoke to you about the board's long-range plan and a vision for the future of higher education in Oregon. I'd like to briefly talk about how we are trying to implement that vision and how student learning and success are integral to the process of planning for the board. In the fall of 2006, the board adopted a set of goals for the Oregon University system related to desired outcomes for the state, reflective of the mission of public higher education throughout the nation and the world. Those goals address student access, high quality learning, knowledge creation and innovation, and economic, civic, and cultural benefits to the state, including those that derive from a well-educated citizenry. Inherent in those goals is a promise to would-be students, if they make the commitment to their own education and are prepared to work hard, then we, as a state system of higher education, want to let them know that there's a place for them in Oregon's colleges and universities, for example, the development of the shared responsibility model. They will have full access to an education on par with the best of anywhere in the country. They will be provided with a stimulating and supportive learning environment, and that they will be well prepared to face the challenges they will encounter in their postgraduate lives, and give back to the society and to the state that supported them in their educational endeavors. to ensure that the promise is meaningful, a system of metrics are being developed that underpin this planning framework that, you will have available to you, and for the operations of the system. In the reports that follow this afternoon, you will hear about the Oregon universities and the Oregon University System's performance assessment system. Fundamental to the educational process, as we all remember from our own educational and school experiences, is assessment and evaluation of outcomes, and an attempt to describe in some way the process and to identify what constitutes success. For students, this takes the form of both classroom-based graded assignments as well as performances on postgraduate assessments like the graduate record exam, the law, the LSAT, the medical boards, and so on. These are assessments that are not ours, not the university system, but they are those that we have to look at and pay attention to, because outside of the system they provide an important set of measures. Among the board's four top priorities among the strategic initiatives are two that I want to just briefly draw your attention to that relate to this presentation today around performance assessment. First, increased or college participation of Oregon high school graduates, whether they're enrolling directly from high school or enrolling via a transfer from community colleges or other universities. We are particularly focused here in terms of access and participation with those students who are typically underserved, first-generation, low-income, rural, and ethnically diverse students. Second among the four top priorities is the development of an Oregon University System portfolio. That is to say, an accumulation, a collection that we are making of reports from the various campuses. We were looking to examine strategically the contributions of each institution, given their distinct missions. And we're trying to integrate those into a collection of what we're calling the Oregon University portfolio, which represents the board's attempt to gather important information from campuses and to compile it into a meaningful analysis of how we're doing as a system. So we're doing both individual student assessment as well as the collective and programmatic kinds of evaluation, as you will hear shortly. Taken as a whole, the set of performance measures reported by the Oregon University System to the state demonstrates significant achievement in the face of declining state support, as you will see. They also, these reports also reveal, as if they were intended to, where we're beginning to experience the effects of long-term erosion and instability in funding. The primary focus of my own research activity, and I realize I'm here as a board member, not as a faculty member, but I am a faculty member. My own research activity has been on student learning and the conditions, attitudes, and pedagogical approaches that foster and enhance the acquisition of knowledge and genuine student success. We as a state have a tremendous asset in our public university system, as you all have made clear over the course of this testimony you agree with. We as a state also have a significant challenge facing us, and we hope that the contribution to our collective work will come from the kind of data that's provided by our performance system. And I want to stop and let Vice Chancellor Susan Weeks present a report on the outcomes and targets for the key performance measures for the Oregon University System. If you have any questions for me first, I'd be happy to respond, but I want to thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Dr. Miller-Jones, and I apologize I wasn't here at the beginning. Are there any questions? Okay. Ms. Weeks.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Weeks, and I'm Vice Chancellor for Strategic Programs and Planning for the Oregon University System. Professor Miller-Jones has just given you the context in which the Board of Higher Education and the Oregon University System frames its performance measurement program. And I know I've met with most of you individually to provide you some background about our performance measurement program. And so I won't go over a great deal of that. I realize that there is a lot there and that you've already had a great deal of that. But as I mentioned in our conversations, I would like to focus just on our key performance measures and connect them as much as I can to funding and funding to our performance outcomes. Let me start by saying that we focus on applying the best practices in performance measurement and how we approach this. And those are three things. One, designing a performance measurement framework that is tied to the mission goals and strategic priorities of our agency. And I think Dr. Miller-Jones just described how we are attempting to do that. Two, a performance measurement program that serves as one component of a broader accountability framework. And so this is, you'll be hearing about performance outcome measures that are related primarily to students and faculty and programs, but this is part of a larger accountability framework that also incorporates financial accountability measures. And three, a focus on measures that meet three criteria for good practice. One is that they measure high-level outcomes. That they measure the results of activities or policies that the agency or institutions, in our case, control or at least heavily influence themselves. And three, that these measures provide a clear way to set and measure targets. I think you have shared with you this particular handout in some of our meetings, and you see a small version of it up on the screen. This represents the conceptual foundation for our OUS performance measurement framework. This was created in the context of the board's adopted long-range plan. At the very top in the blue box, you see that it connects two broad benchmarks within the Oregon targeted benchmarks related to higher education. Along the left column, you see the four primary goals adopted by the board. In the middle, the desired outcomes flowing from those goals. And on the right column, the critical success drivers important to achieving those outcomes and goals. And so this represents the conceptual framework and foundation for the development of our performance measurement program and framework. The next slide is also something which I shared with you, which is our performance measurement framework. And I'm obviously not going to go through all the things that are written here, but the idea behind this is to represent not only the measures that we track and target as performance measures, but also to give you a feel for the other kinds of data that we routinely track and monitor, even though they are not performance measures. They do serve to inform our performance outcomes. The matrix is intended to convey the set of measures that are connected to the four broad goals, which you see represented vertically, and measure different levels of decision making, which you see represented along the row categories. And the reason that this is important is that I think it will connect to some of my comments later about how we report measures to the state. Right now, as you know, we have a collection of 29-plus measures that we report to the state. But those are not necessarily, they have not been developed necessarily applying the best practices and the criteria that I just mentioned. And I think one of those is the level of decision-making that is most appropriate for what you all are faced with and what you need to know from us and what we provide to our board and what the institutions in turn are expected to maintain to provide in-depth analysis for these kinds of measures. This is still a work in progress, and some of the measures at the top may change, but we are working with our board on this, and this represents the framework that we would like to adopt as our performance framework. In the next slide, As I just mentioned, we do provide 29 performance indicators, but what I'm hoping to do on this slide is illustrate how we might organize and harmonize what we're trying to do with our board and with our long-range plan and the performance metrics within that framework with what we are currently providing to the state. That first set of blocks you see at the top represent the broad goals, and I know I said there are four broad goals and you see five blocks, but that's because I took one of those goals and broke them into two, the access for our Oregonians and the educated citizenry, but these do represent the broad goals of the board, against which we develop our performance measurement program. On the ovals that have just popped up there, you'll see these represent the areas of measurement related primarily to student success. And there is a flow to them. And so they do relate to, at the point of entry, the multiple pathways to college, through their progress through the university, and their success at the end of the line and their contributions to the state following graduation. And so these represent the measurement areas that we are trying to focus on in our metrics. The six boxes at the bottom represent the high-level outcome measures that I'm hoping to focus on in my presentation today. And they also relate to another handout that I know you've seen an earlier draft. But these also flow along the continuum from participation rate, reflecting the point of entry, through retention completion, the award of degrees, and another one of our very important missions in higher education, research and innovation. And so we think that these six high-level outcome measures represent, at a very high level, the key indicators that would be appropriate to report to all of you and to discuss with you. All the stuff in between, those are the 29 indicators that we currently report, and I've highlighted in red the six that I'm focusing on today, but those are all 29 of them arrayed as much as we could underneath each of the key goal areas. So you get a sense of how many we are currently reporting and where they might fall. Let me refer now to this handout it should be in your packet or in your notebook for today. It's a six-sheet handout of the key performance measures, one page or one sheet for each of the six. And it's in the format I described to you when we met, which provides not only the actual data and the targets for the particular measure, but also some context, other measures that relate to it, how it relates to the
Excuse me, we're trying to locate this. Do you have a page number?
Oh, I'm so sorry. It should be in your notebook in section 7, day 3.
Mr. Chair, it's on the material I have for today.
I guess I was going to ask. I'm looking at this piece of paper.
The front picture of it is on the slide, but the full handout with all of the information.
It's under day 3?
Yeah, under day 3.
Oh, I see.
Thank you. Sorry about that. And so I'll walk through each one of those. I won't walk through each one of those sheets, but those are points of reference for this conversation. The first one is the freshman participation rate, which is the percentage of Oregon high school graduates who enroll at OUS University. This is something that OUS actually has less control over, and so for that reason it's not a perfect measure. It doesn't meet all three of the criteria. But it is a measure of how well Oregon as a state is doing in providing access to high school graduates. And monitoring the freshman participation rate helps the board gauge the implementation of its strategic priorities, and such as raising aspirations for college and serving how we serve underrepresented populations. And so we believe this is a good measure to track. The next slide gives a little bit more detail and granularity to this measure. I think it points out some important things. This may look a little familiar because I think you saw this in Chancellor Prinsteiner's presentation on day one. This is the freshman participation rate over a longer period of time, and you can see the roller coaster ride that it takes. When you look at on the far left side of it, after a high point at that time of almost 23%, after the deep recession of the early 1980s, it dropped precipitously to 17.8%, which is the lowest we've ever had. As we were coming out of that recession and began to recover, the freshman participation rate began to recover. Our budgets improved, and the support for students improved, and we reached a high of 23% in the late 1980s. Then Measure 5 happened, And you can see what happened to the freshman participation rate with enrollment cuts and program closures and very sharp tuition increases. That freshman participation rate dropped to 18.4%. Again, as we started coming out of that and increasing some state support, and particularly in the 1999-01 biennium when the legislature appropriated a much greater amount of state support for higher education. You can see what that did to freshman participation, to enrollment, and we'll see later on, subsequently, to degrees awarded. It made a huge difference. It increased to 24%, which was a record for us. Since that time, with the recession and the cuts in budgets, it has fallen again and now is at back down to 20.1%. So it is highly dependent on state support, and this is a real measure of access for students and what the state does or doesn't do in its investment in student access. I do want to point out that in that period of time, from Measure 5 until, through the decade of the 90s, really, if we had been able to maintain that freshman participation rate throughout that period rather than having it fall the way it did, we would have enrolled thousands more students. And our estimate is that the degrees produced from those additional students, from that what we call lost generation, would have made the difference between having a younger population of Oregonians today that is at the lower end of educational attainment and having a population of younger Oregonians at least at the U.S. average, if not above. It would have made that much difference. Let's look at the next measure, which is retention rate. This is the percentage of first-year students who return to college for the second year. From the mid-1990s to 2001, we saw steady increases in this rate as the universities implemented programs and efforts aimed at improving retention. But the rates leveled off after 2001, and now, in fall of 2006, they've started to decline. This is a short-term measure, and we think that it's valuable to you and to us to have a mix of short- and long-term measures. This is one of the shorter-term, early warning type of measures. And this, along with freshman participation rate, also a short-term measure, provides a good early indication of where we are starting to kind of fray at the edges. We know from both the broader research literature and our own experience in surveys that high retention rates reflect solid academic preparation, student engagement with faculty, and particularly for at-risk students, those who are first-generation, low-income, primarily in rural areas, the availability of student support and advising services. There was a recent survey by the Oregon Student Association that noted that cuts to student services have had a particular impact on at-risk students, and indeed our own retention studies and analysis have demonstrated that significant improvements in retention and completion rates occur when at-risk students have advising, mentoring, monitoring, and tutoring services available to them. Unfortunately, these are often the services that are cut as campuses have faced declining resources. In the OSA survey and in our own follow-up survey of OUS graduate students indicate a high level of satisfaction with access to faculty and with the helpfulness of faculty. But as student-faculty ratios have risen over the past several years, as enrollment grew without commensurate funding for faculty, the important connections between students and faculty have been eroding. And we may be seeing some of that in the trends now. You'll hear more about these critical success factors later on today from Professor Ayers in her presentation.
Ms. Weeks, quick question. You have faculty salaries, recruitment and retention, and ratio of students to full-time faculty. So, and maybe this will be covered later, the sort of shift or the increasing number of part-time or adjunct faculty, does that have a large impact on retention?
Mr. Chair, yes, it has an impact on the academic environment, the learning environment. To the extent that it is the regular rank full-time faculty who are providing advising and other kinds of ongoing assistance to students outside of the classroom, not just in class, but outside of the classroom. When you have a greater proportion of adjunct part-time faculty and a smaller proportion of these full-time regular ink faculty, you have a much greater burden on the regular ink faculty to handle that advising load, and as a result, there just isn't the kind of time that they would normally have to provide that kind of support to students, and that kind of support is critical in retaining students and keeping them engaged. The graduation rate is similar to the trends for retention rates. The six-year graduation rate, and this is the time frame that is reported nationally. It doesn't mean that all students graduate in 6 years. In fact, in our system, most graduate in about 4.5 years. But this is the time frame for the national reports. That has risen steadily since 1995 from 53% to nearly 59% today. But this is one of the long-term indicators. We need to keep that in mind, and that the current increases reflect the cohort of students that entered 4, 5, and 6 years ago, and that the declining retention rates that you just saw are going to be reflected in the next 4, 5, and 6 years. And so we need to keep in mind the long-term view of this and what the impact of what we do today will have on what happens a few years from now. In addition to the student support and student-faculty ratio issues noted for retention, course availability affects the length of time students take to complete a degree. The OSA survey found that 43% of the seniors and 40% of the juniors surveyed said that the inability to get a needed class extended their time in college. Budget cuts have affected the number and sequencing of courses available to students to complete their programs, and this likely will have an effect on the graduation rates as well. One piece of good news is that the completion rates and degrees awarded for Oregon Community College transfers to OUS, which are not shown in these data but are a separate measure that we do track, have improved, and I think that in part reflects the additional work in alignment and articulation in the recent years, and I think that we're starting to see some successes there.
So how do you square the pressure to offer more sections with the pressure to not have many courses with a low number of students?
Mr. Chair, that is a challenge for campuses, and I know that all of our campuses are looking at that issue and have been looking at how to make sure that there is the right kind of sequencing and availability for students, and at the same time have an efficient way of offering those courses. I'd like to defer that question perhaps to Provost Rondalo, who is in a better position to speak very directly to it.
But I think we can say that there is a trend now toward larger student-faculty ratios.
Let's see, bachelor's degrees. If I had to give you just one single measure that we would use for the Oregon University System's performance program, it would be this one. It would be the number of bachelor's degrees awarded. This is the outcome measure that reflects really all of the other measures that I just described: the freshman participation, first-year retention, and graduation rate. It's the outcome measure that will gauge how well OUS contributes to the broad goal of higher educational attainment in the state. So I think this is a particularly critical one. If we look on the next slide, this gets at a little bit more linear look, I think, at a more focused look. This is total degrees, not just bachelor's degrees, so it includes both the graduate and the undergraduate degrees. But it shows you what can happen with additional state investment. As I had shown in the freshman participation rate graph, likewise on this, as investment increased, output increased, the outcomes improved. The 1999 legislature increased the appropriation sufficiently to fund additional enrollment and improve freshman participation rates, and you can see 4, 5, and 6 years later, we had a much higher number of degrees produced. Prior to that infusion of dollars, we were at about, as you can see in the early data points here, at about the 13,000 degree level. Following that, and beginning 4 years later and increasing after that, you can see a big jump in the number of degrees produced. This was something that had was a very direct result of that infusion of resources. However, this is a long-term measure, and it's a little bit harder to see some of the immediate warning signs that threaten it. While the total number of degrees has been increasing, recently that hasn't been the case at every single campus. At two of our institutions, the number of degrees in 2006 actually was lower than the year before, and for two others, the level of degree production in the last 2 years was lower than it had been in the previous few years. So even here, we're starting to see some of that fraying at the edges. It's masked a little bit by the totals, but we're beginning to see that happen as well. Chancellor Princeteiner noted in his remarks last week that Oregon will be facing some significant demographic changes that will impact our ability to achieve our educational attainment goals. And in particular, I'd like to note that the growing Latino population, which historically has had lower participation and completion rates, will mean that OUS will need much greater resource support to assure full opportunity and success for all Oregonians in the future. The next measure, advanced degrees. You don't probably hear as much from us about advanced degrees as you do about bachelor's degrees, but master's and PhD degrees are essential for many of the key workforce areas of the knowledge economy. We began to see increases in graduate degrees following the 1999 state investment, and because master's programs in particular are shorter than bachelor's programs, we saw the results earlier. So between 2001 and 2005, the number of advanced degrees awarded grew by almost 1,000, from 3,560 to over 4,500. However, in 2006, there was a drop in the number of degrees awarded, very likely the result of a smaller graduate enrollment in 2004. And the cost is also playing a role in graduate enrollment. The OSA survey showed that having significant debt from undergraduate education prevents many students from choosing to enroll in graduate school. Graduate degree production is even more influenced than undergraduate degree production by faculty and program availability and reputation, and by research and fellowship funding. While we project continued growth in graduate degrees, that growth is highly dependent on our also being able to recruit and retain high-quality faculty and to support the research infrastructure that includes faculty, programs, and facilities. And finally, our sixth measure, sponsored research expenditures. Research and knowledge creation is a critical part of the OUS mission. It provides direct economic benefits through research commercialization and in contributions to learning. Oregon's public university faculty are among the most productive in the country, ranking seventh in the federal R&D expenditures per faculty. And annual sponsored research dollars brought in by OUS faculty have doubled since 1995, reaching a high of $317 million in the last fiscal year. But again, continued success is dependent on the ability to attract and retain productive faculty, and as Professor Joe noted last week, having a strong research infrastructure of facilities, libraries, and associated support.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me for interrupting. Is there any one particular academic area that we're excelling in this research? The reference being that we rank seventh in the U.S. in R&D dollars per faculty. Is there any one concentration area that is excelling that we should be sensitive to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, there are a number of areas in which there's growth. There's growth at every single campus. It's been really astounding. But I think in particular where we are also very highly ranked nationally are in areas related to natural resources and sustainability and many of those areas. There are also other areas in which we are highly ranked, education at the University of Oregon and other areas as well. I would be happy to follow up with a more complete listing of where those concentrations are located. But those are a couple that I know are the case for you.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
The University of Oregon, the Eugene, the Register Guard has had editorials in the last couple of weeks. I think at least two, and there may have been more than that. One of them was about the relative rank of the OUS system as compared to other universities and the growth in research funds available. You may not be prepared for it today, but I'd like a critique of those editorials because the numbers that they gave are significantly different than the numbers that you're proposing, and I'd like to know why. They may just simply be wrong, or it may be that they're measuring something in a different way than you are. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we'd be happy to bring back an analysis of that.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Senator Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to state that while I was not here on Wednesday and Thursday, I did read an article while I was away. I know some people have problems with the U.S. News and World Report ranking of graduate schools, but I did note in there that the School of Education at the U of O was ranked 12th in the nation and had particularly high numbers compared to the other schools who were ranked in education in research dollars compared to some of those. And it's actually the only that in the University of Oregon Law School were the only two programs that showed up, I believe, in the whole report. But
it's not entirely true. The Portland State Community Service is highly ranked as well, but not in the research domain, I think is what you're referring to.
Yeah. And, of course, nobody in the academic community cares about the U.S. News and World Report rankings.
No, and I think the reason that the program was, Mr. Chairman, the reason it wasn't ranked is because it only had very specific programs that didn't include that area.
Yes, that's true. Okay. Let me just summarize, then, our progress on these key broad outcome measures. Used of up and down arrows, red, green, and yellow here to indicate where we see our progress or lack thereof. We're looking at some warning signs in the freshman participation rate, retention rate, and in the number of advanced degrees awarded. While our graduation rates continue to increase and improve to the credit of the institutions that are putting a lot of effort into that, nevertheless, our current declines in retention rates foreshadow a warning sign there. And with respect to bachelor's degrees, it's sort of equivocal. We do have increases, but as I mentioned, with the declines at a couple of institutions and then at a couple more in the last 2 years, I think that's something we need to be alert to as a potential warning sign. And let me conclude with just a few issues for the future, and then I'll turn this over to my colleagues.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor Weeks, how are you?
I am fine, thank you.
As noted in the Chancellor's letter to us this afternoon, there's a $35 million gap between the Governor's recommended budget for OUS operating budget and the co-chair's budget. If forced to choose between making investments in the shared responsibility model and or the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, or alternately shoring up the operating budget for OUS, which of those two courses would you recommend we take?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, you've really given me a question there.
I would just advise you to keep in mind the metrics that are on this particular slide, and we're looking at declines in freshman participation, the retention rate, advanced degrees, and nominal, if any, progress in bachelor's degrees. So given that, and your understanding of the drivers of those phenomena, which course would you recommend?
Well, I'd like very much to defer and answer that, but I will tell you that I think that obviously cost is a huge factor for in terms of access, but it is not the only factor. And there are other issues that affect access, that affect participation, the preparation, the ability to receive the kinds of services once they are in school, to get through to complete a degree. There are a lot of other factors involved that also relate to institutional capacity. And I would not want to lose sight of the importance of that.
Just here, I didn't respond. I think it's a difficult question, and an unfortunate one to have to raise. I don't see how, from the board's perspective, we can move forward without doing both. I don't think we can make that choice. I think that you have to provide the underpinnings for student support to get the access, but you can't just affect these performance indicators by funding a student access process. You've got to support the operations of the university system.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Just a comment. I just want to clarify that by the nature of my question, I didn't mean to imply that it was a reasonable trade-off. Just wanted to get your input, given that it's one of the options that others have mentioned.
Thank you. Senator Devlin. I wanted to ask a pretty broad question, and that is, my entire history here, which isn't that long, it's only 11 years, the only year that I've seen a big increase in higher ed funding was 1999. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me what some of the impacts of that were on the institutions and how that... I know that our performance measures really don't go back that far, at least not accurately, but what the impacts were on the institutions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I'd be happy to. And our performance measures, or at least much of our data that now contribute to our performance measures, go back pretty far. And I think some of them I have described, and those are the improvement in the ability to bring in more students into the system to enroll. That was the last time we had enrollment, funding for enrollment, for increased enrollment in students, for students. So the freshman participation rate, which bears very directly on that ability, shows that result. We began to see the improvement in retention and student where institutions were able to fund some of the student services and things that would help keep students in school. And we saw some of the growth in the retention rates following that. The investment payoff really was 4, 5, and 6 years later, which we have now seen in the number of degrees produced as a result. And I think those are the key outcomes from that investment.
Mr. Chairman, as difficult as Representative Edwards' question seemed, not to even make it more difficult, but part of the reality is some of those unpleasant choices are the choices that are actually necessary. You probably don't want to comment on this, but his choice was between funding the increased student assistance or better funding the institutions. The co-chair's request for Head Start is $11 million below the governor's request, and actually now $20 million below the cost to actually fund Head Start at 80%, which is deemed to be equivalent to full funding. If I was looking at this as a continuum, and I had to make the three choices of where to put $20 million, where would be the best use of it? I wouldn't make it rhetorical.
But that's the real choice.
You could take it as a rhetorical.
But it's a choice. It's not a...
This is why we get $99 citizenry does not require Head Start. That's the first observation I'd like to make. Mm-hmm. So if you want a preventive set of measures, you invest in the prevention. But we also need to have Head Start money. So I think the tough task before you as legislatures are to make those kinds of decisions on the best possible information you have. My own decision would be to do both. I'm sorry, but it's a bad message. It's one that we have got to start hearing and acting on.
Thank you. I just have a couple of concluding remarks, if you're, with your indulgence.
Absolutely.
As we look toward the future, I think there are a couple of points I'd like to make. With respect to how we report performance outcomes to the state, we'd recommend three changes in how from current practice. The one first thing, to streamline the process for selection, review, and deletion of measures, employing the principles of best practice that I mentioned earlier. I don't think that is necessarily the case now, but I think that doing so would improve both what we provide and what you receive. Secondly, to clarify the basis in which targets are to be set, particularly with respect to funding level assumptions. Right now it is not clear what kinds of assumptions are being made in our setting of targets with regard to funding support underlying those targets, and so I think some clarity there would be very helpful. And third, I think it would make more sense to set periodic targets, benchmarks, say every 5 years, rather than requiring annual reporting and target setting. And the reason for this is that I think that would keep a longer-term vision in front of agencies who are setting those targets. It would take away some of the disincentives that agencies, or in our case institutions, might have now to do innovative or experimental things that could have a very good long-term payoff, but may not have a short-term payoff. And when you're required to set those annual kinds of targets, you're a little bit conservative about what you might try to do for a long-term outcome. And so I think having something like a 5-year benchmark would in some ways make a lot more sense with year-to-year monitoring so that there's reporting back, but not the actual target setting year-to-year. And these would be our recommendations for future reporting. And secondly, OUS will be developing more direct measures of student learning and success. This is a very big and complex undertaking, and few states are actually doing this very well yet. We first have to have a good grounding and understanding about what leads to student success, and then we need to develop and test measurement approaches, taking into consideration mission differences among institutions, the need for program or discipline-based assessment versus general education assessment, and a focus on an absolute level of knowledge acquired versus value added by the institution. Those are some of the considerations in looking at learning assessment. And the next part of our presentation by Provost Sabah Randhawa from Oregon State University will focus on how OUS institutions are now beginning to develop a framework for a thoughtful approach to learning assessment and measurement. And then finally, because faculty are the ones who understand best and are the greatest influence over student learning and success, they must be the foundation of any learning assessment program that we may develop. And to that end, Professor Lee Ayers from Southern Oregon University and as Vice President of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate will speak to you about the elements of student success and the resource challenges that faculty face in trying to affect student success. Thank you very much for the opportunity to report on this to you, and before turning it over to Provost Randhawa, I'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Senator Morse?
Thank you. The 29 performance measurements, are they developed for you or for us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, that's an excellent question. And actually, there's nothing wrong with those 29 measures. Those are actually, in and of themselves, are good measures. The question, I think the issue is, are they measures that are targeted to the right level of decision making? They are measures that are probably, many of them, very good for our board to be looking at with respect to institutional management and oversight. But as broad outcome measures for the state. I think many of them are a little too micro. The measures themselves are perfectly fine, but I think in some cases they've become too granular, too detailed for the level of decision making that you are faced with as a legislature.
As a follow-up, Mr. Chair, the next question would be, will you be making recommendations with respect to appropriate performance measurements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, yes, we will. We did not bring those recommendations forward this time because our board is in the process now of conducting what Dr. Miller-Jones just referred to as the portfolio, the OUS portfolio conversations and assessments over the course of this year with our campuses. And we would like to make sure that our performance metrics reflect those conversations and those discussions and where the board ends up in looking at the overall OUS portfolio. And so when we get through that process, which is really the first implementation phase of the long-range plan, then we'll be in a better position to come forward with a recommendation, and I would expect we would make propose significant changes from what we have now. We didn't want to start now and do it piecemeal until we had gotten through the end of that process at the end of this calendar year.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. When do you anticipate that happening?
Mr. Chair, I'm guessing it can't happen before the end of 2007 because that's our calendar for working with the institutions, but I would hope that we could start looking at those changes early in 2008.
Before February? We don't want that? Or forget it, no. Okay. After February.
But before Senator Morse's question, you had some recommendations, kind of big picture recommendations. It would be, I think, useful to have those written down.
I'd be happy to.
Sounds like it could be a one sheet. So that would be great because I think those are really important recommendations and appreciated those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to provide those.
Oh, Senator Dillon.
As you change or make recommendations to change your performance measures, maybe even to simplify them a little bit further, because this is actually probably the second or third level of simplification already, if my memory is correct. Can you be cognizant of the need to at least be relating to some data so we have some history? Because often what we find with changes in performance measures is we change what we're measuring, and then we literally have no history and very little ability to judge progress or lack thereof. And the other thing that, to be personally, that I dislike about this process, and don't take this as a negative about the Legislative Audits Committee, you're not going to do that. You're going to come back probably in the next biennium with proposed changes. But a lot of times we refer people onto the Legislative Audits Committee, which is a fine committee. But they really don't have a focus on some of the areas where they would almost be better off coming back to a subcommittee like this, or at least being reviewed by an education subcommittee or an education policy committee. Because what happens is we ask for performance measure changes, they go off to the Legislative Audits Committee, we come back in again and then as a subcommittee, and we see these changes in performance measures that we had no opportunity to comment on, really. And, you know, many times we have issues with those changes that have been made. I just think it's better to probably wait till the next biennium. But I just hope that we can retain some of the data.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I completely agree with your second point. And to your first point, I really hate it when people come up with new measures and don't provide the historical context for it. And we try very hard to make sure we provide your historical data. And the only time where we wouldn't is if it simply didn't exist. But otherwise, we certainly would do that.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much, Ms. Weeks. Dr. Miller-Jones.
Good afternoon.
Please,
Mr. Chair, Members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony today. For the record, my name is Sabah Randhawa. I'm the Provost and Executive Vice President of Oregon State University. Today I'd like to talk to you about some of the major elements of the student learning and assessment process, its role in ensuring student success, and how the OUS institutions are implementing this process. There are essentially two overarching goals for student learning and assessment. The first goal is to ensure student success as an outcome. Student success, as measured by a set of quantitative and qualitative metrics, and many of them Susan shared with you earlier on, and I'll get back to this point in a little while. And the second key goal is to ensure that the universities continuously improve their academic programs and the overall learning and teaching environment. And so from this perspective, the role of student learning assessment is really gap analysis and continuous quality improvement of the institutions. Student learning goals and their assessment depend on academic programs. They're driven by academic programs, which in turn, of course, are driven by the goals and priorities of the universities in the systems framework, and some of the key principles in terms of assessment. So, if you can go to the next slide. Okay, you've heard earlier about the OUS strategic framework, and Dr. Miller-Jones also referred to it, but basically the key drivers as far as student learning outcomes are access, quality, new knowledge generation, and contribution to economic and social development. In addition to the broad OUS goals, the OUS institutions have collectively defined a set of guiding principles for really to help us in defining assessment practices. And let me just briefly mention a few of them to you. A commitment to excellence in each dimension of our missions, be it teaching, research, or outreach and engagement. With respect to undergraduate education, this commitment requires us to set high expectations for students, assess how the university experience prepares students beyond graduation, and then use the information we gain through assessment to continuously improve our teaching and learning environment, and this is where the gap analysis and continuous improvement comes in. OUS institutions strive to provide consistency in measures of fundamental learning outcomes, particularly those around general education core curriculum, and I'll get back to this point here in a minute, while at the same time we seek to develop assessment practices that are adaptive to reflect distinctive institutional missions. Finally, one of the things here I want to emphasize is that one of our objectives is to learn from and benchmark against the best practices for student learning and assessment, what happens at other institutions, and what we learn over time. And so one of the most important lessons from research and empirical work in this area is that learning and assessment needs to encompass the entire student experience, not just the classrooms, not just the actual academic experience, but perhaps even more important, the physical, social, and the emotional, spiritual growth of students. And so part of the assessment process is defining elements that can encompass those other dimensions of student life at campus. Some of the key lessons that we have tried to adopt and adapt in our practices: contact with faculty as mentors in and out of the classroom is really critical. Engagement in activities that reinforce curriculum and desired outcomes is critical, and these are elements like internships, service learning, international exchange programs, but activities that reinforce a lot of the curriculum in the classroom. Timely feedback and expectations. Another element that is really important in terms of learning and that has been proven time and time again is peer-to-peer mentoring opportunities where students students can teach students to improve. And so one of the places where we have tried to accommodate that has been in developing transition learning communities, where we have a cohort of students working together through a suite of classes as they go along. And then finally, an environment that accommodates a diversity of learning styles. Similarly, in terms of assessment, there are a number of best practices that we have tried to focus on, again, encompassing the entire collective educational experience, focusing on value added, looking at both quantitative measures, such as retention and graduation rates, but also at qualitative indicators that reflect students' and employers' perception of learning. And we have a number of surveys that we do on a regular basis to see where we are with respect to that element. Before I get into the second half of this graph, let me just mention that over the past few years, there has been considerable debates on student learning outcomes, both at the national level and here in Oregon, too. And let me just mention two activities. The work of the Spillings Commission at the national level over the past few months have generated a lot of thinking and a lot of debate. It's the work that was commissioned by Secretary of Education Margaret Spillings. Where basically she asked a group of leaders from business, academia, and government to look at higher education, and what they ended up doing was making a series of recommendations to improve accessibility, affordability, and accountability of higher education. In particular, with respect to student learning outcomes, their recommendation, again, these are at fairly broad aggregate level, their recommendation was for institutions to develop a robust culture of accountability and transparency with a greater focus on student learning and development of more outcome-based accreditation system. And they have a set of recommendations for financial aid and a number of other areas. Within Oregon, OUS institutions have been involved in looking at our practices and rethinking what our students do. But in particular, SB 342, Senate Bill 342, over the past year, 18 months, has served as a catalyst to expedite work in this area. And so, as you may know, the OUS institutions have been working with the Oregon Community Colleges in coordinating articulation and statewide transfer systems. We've also been looking at developing a better common understanding of desired outcomes for general education, and in particular, seamless transfer of credits at the 100 and 200 level courses. And so there has been considerable amount of work that has been going on, though some of it still needs to be completed. Let me briefly expand on the work that OUS institutions have done with regard to assessment of learning outcomes. First of all, point out that faculty members really drive the curriculum development, and so the development of the assessment process itself. They define and assess learning outcomes that are associated with general education requirements for undergraduate students, as well as specific requirements in disciplinary-based major and professional programs. I've used the term general education a number of times, and I just want to clarify that when we talk about general education, we are really focused on intellectual skills such as critical and creative thinking, written and oral communication, teamwork and problem solving, information literacy, quantitative literacy, intercultural knowledge, basically skills that you would expect every undergraduate student, irrespective of their major, to have by the time they graduate from any of the public universities. The intention is that students are introduced to these skills in this curriculum, the general education core, and that is something that is reinforced as they go through their major program of study. And so this is in particular the set of skills that we are focused on in developing and defining jointly with the community college system, because increasingly a higher proportion of students coming into OUS are coming from community colleges where they take many of these general education courses. It, The second slide here, I'm just going to take about 30 seconds, and it's primarily to give a perspective on the assessment process overall. Again, the fact that on the left-hand side of the slide, that the academic programs flow from the institution missions, the key components there are the curriculum, the faculty that are qualified to deliver that curriculum, the physical and the information infrastructure that is needed to provide that curriculum, and then the student support services that go beyond the classrooms. And then that is translated into more lower, what are the contents of each course that are going to satisfy that overall curricula. The right-hand side box essentially is what I'll call the assessment process. And basically, as you could see, it's gap analysis. What do we expect? What are the students learning? In assessing that, we get input from employers, from alumni, from accreditation agencies in terms of the criteria they have set. And then, as I said earlier, it's essentially a feedback process in terms of how do we use that to improve our academic programs and the teaching and learning environment. The Oregon University system and each of the universities have processes in place in terms of assessing each academic program periodically. And part of that assessment is assessment of student learning outcomes. The second important activity that really focusing on assessment is accreditation. This occurs at two levels. Regional accreditation of the institution as a whole and accreditation of individual professional programs. The regional accreditation agency is the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities. It reviews each programs each university on a 10-year cycle, but typically there is a 5-year mid-tenure review. And then if there is any major changes in the mission of the institution or any major additions or deletion of programs, then there are additional reviews. And part of that review process is looking at student assessment and student learning. And the second key component of accreditation is accreditation of professional programs such as engineering, business, education, journalism, architecture, pharmacy, vet med, public health, where we are periodically assessed in terms of the programs, in terms of the student learning outcomes. And most of the professional programs are well advanced as far as this whole area of accreditation and student learning is concerned. Engineering, for example, introduced outcome-based education in 2000-2001, so it's almost been at least 6 years since that process has been going on, and that's true for many of the professional programs. The next step in the process here is, first of all, as you have heard earlier, the State Board of Higher Education has instituted the process of looking at each institution in terms of its mission, in terms of its goals, and that will help refine at our institutions our academic portfolio. We are continuing to work with the community colleges, particularly around the general education core, that is the common core transferred among community colleges and higher institutions in terms of defining learning outcomes to ensure that we minimize duplication of effort and minimize the amount of time students spend in the system as a whole in terms of graduation. And then, as I said earlier, with respect to our professional accreditation programs, we are really well advanced in this whole area. Where we fall short is in academic areas where we do not have external accreditation requirements, like, for example, in the humanities or basic sciences. And so each of the institutions is engaged in developing similar level of student learning and assessment processes for those areas, and our goal is to have it in place by in the next 3 years, by 2010. So to summarize, assessment is a means to an end, where the end is student success and the end is continuous improvement in what we do. Assessment, as I said earlier, is essentially a gap analysis and a process for continuous improvement of what we do, and we'll continue to work on it. And the last thing, and I apologize, I had to step out for a minute. I understand there was a question regarding small class sizes at our institutions, and in just overall how that fits into the metrics that we are talking about. And perhaps, again, I didn't capture the question since I wasn't here, but what I wanted to point out was that what we are looking at when we talk about class sizes really is an average across the 4 years, actually plus the graduate degrees. And so particularly when you get into the upper division courses, the junior, senior, and the graduate courses, the class sizes are relatively small, again, depending on the discipline. So in mechanical engineering at OSU, we have 80 graduates each year. So we have much bigger class sizes versus, for example, in forest engineering, where we have about 15 graduates. The key issue is really in the first 2 years, where we are talking, and that's also what impacts the most the retention rate. It's also most critical because it is at this stage we are talking about the social adjustment of students coming from different communities into bigger universities, and so that's where we struggle the most in terms of class sizes. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Appreciate your attention. Or
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked for quite a little bit about accreditation issues involving a particular subject matter. And I think one of the things you said was that in many areas there are national accrediting institutions in those areas, and they've done the work. The essential work of making certain subjects cover what they are supposed to and that standards are correct. Are you working with other institutions outside of the state of Oregon in an overarching way to deal with accreditation issues for the sciences and humanities that you indicated don't have those kinds of professional or at least outside standards organizations?
We are working with other institutions, not so much in terms of defining the equivalent of accreditation agencies, like, for example, we have in the professional programs, but we certainly are working with them in terms of what are the best practices that they have used in assessing, in defining learning outcomes for these areas, in assessing those outcomes. We are also looking at the professional schools where we have history, and what are the lessons learned that we can adapt to liberal arts and to the basic sciences. So we are actively engaged, both academic leadership as well as many of our faculty are quite active in terms of trying to figure out what can we learn from other institutions.
So just follow up on that. I mean, so there are national organizations of national scope that our faculty are working in conjunction with as we work on developing these standards and outcomes, the outcome standards and the original benchmarks themselves.
That is true.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. How do you pronounce your last name?
Rinalva.
That was perfect. I'm not going to ruin it. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Dr. Ayers?
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lee Ayers, and I'm an associate tenure professor of criminology and criminal justice at Southern Oregon University. I'm also the current vice president for the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, better known as the IFF. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. More students are seeking the opportunity to go to college. Why? Because the world is complex. People in all walks of life are more in need of knowledge than ever before. Today's students pursue knowledge in a various variety of ways, to include live classes, online courses, even hybrid courses as they go. As faculty, we have worked collectively to adopt our approaches based on this new reality. The IFS works closely with community colleges on the Oregon Transfer Module, the AAOT, the College Now programs, and Senate Bill 342. These efforts to facilitate student credit transfer and success across educational sectors also includes new approaches to ensure educational quality. Meaningful commitment to educational excellence begins with the agreement about goals for student learning. Aligning general education objectives with career objectives creates a circle, and measuring student achievement will complete it. Across the system, the commitment to excellence in education is demonstrated by the passion of our faculty for student success, which is closely interwoven into the fabric of effective teaching and learning outcomes. Faculty across the system are giving clear focus to the kinds of learning students need for a complex world. Community-based learning, along with the development of an understanding of the impact of the cultures on globalization, are a must for today's learners in preparing for the global workforce and economy. As Bob Herbert of the New York Times notes, quote, "If you look at India, China, and Russia, even if you discount the 90% of the people who are uneducated farmers, you will end up with about 300 million people who are educated. That is larger than the entire American workforce." End of quote. Students today must be empowered, informed, and responsible for their learning throughout the learning process. Empowered learners exhibit intellectual and practical skills gained through the K-12 experience, but are further enhanced by developing them in higher education. These include effective communication skills, qualitative and quantitative analytical ability to problem solve, knowing how to interpret and evaluate information and resources, and understanding how to work in a system that is complex with diverse groups. Successful learners demonstrate intellectual agility and manage change, transforming information into knowledge through judgments and actions. The faculty in the Oregon Public Universities work on a daily basis to help students become the empowered learners they must be to enter into and succeed in today's workplace. They also become the kind of people that you want to hire for your organizations because of what they bring with their professional endeavors. Why did I become a teacher, and why do I love to teach? It's because I can be a contributor and a witness to the learning that takes place. That light bulb that goes on, that aha moment. It's because of my great love for teaching and students that I am so saddened and frustrated by the budget constraints that are keeping me from giving the students the time and the attention that I would so dearly love to give each and every one of them. There is just simply not enough hours in the week to accomplish the list of to-do things in the manner of which it takes to mentor and monitor and teach and touch the students who are so desperately in need. We know what it takes to create an effective learning environment, such things as the opportunity for students to work closely and directly with faculty, and having faculty regularly available to mentor and monitor student progress. This is particularly critical at the universities that have a larger portion of first-generation, lower-income students who need the close faculty interaction to thrive, especially in those critical first years. Recently, I spoke with several Success at Southern students, all of whom fell into that first-generation college student category. When asked, why do you stay at SOU, the common theme that emerged was, quote, "the professors, they will bend over backwards for you," end of quote. These students also noted that had there not been the faculty mentoring encouragement that they received early on in those first few years, especially that first year, they probably would have dropped out. Noting that although in high school they could fail a quiz and simply retake it, or gloss over textbooks and just get by, they noted, quote, "it's not like that at the university level. You can't fake it. You have to digest it or you'll die," end of quote. The students noted in their majors, in this particular case, criminology and chemistry, that faculty have gone the extra mile by taking on extra time in the lab or making time available to mentor and monitor them, to apply world concepts to the real phenomena within their office of tutoring. The students also noted the wonderful internship opportunities that faculty help make available and secured. This gives them experience that they can now note on their resume. Internships and research are very important parts of the learning process. And at SOU, everyone completes a capstone within their area of discipline or major. One of the most effective learning approaches is to provide students at all levels the opportunity to engage in research. Indeed, this is one of the board's priorities in its long-term plan. But it is very labor-intensive, but extremely valuable from the learning perspective, and it simply cannot be done with today's funding model. As a faculty member, I can attest to the fact that the learning environment for which I am trying so desperately to prepare students to meet these objectives has changed in the 9 years that I have been serving at Southern Oregon University. You have heard from many presenters today about this faculty-to-student ratio and the need to reduce them. So what exactly does this mean? Well, for a department like criminology and criminal justice at SOU, it means 4 full-time faculty and nearly 300 majors. Please allow me to tell you what that means for our students. I have no fewer than 70 advisees per term that I am the primary advisor, guiding them through this complicated web of requirements, providing counseling, and assuring them that they can do what it takes to succeed and earn their degree. This means that I meet to discuss employment possibilities, educational dreams and goals, even help them plan courses for a timely graduation or those mandated junior-senior plans. It is nearly impossible at this time to meet all the needs of so many. Lack of investment in higher education has precipitated in other issues that affect student learning and success as well. Class sizes in the criminology, criminal justice department have swollen to 80 in lower division courses. That's the 1 in 200 level, and nearly 60 in upper division core courses. This has meant a change in assessment techniques and dependency on time efficiency assessment, such as those loved multiple choice tests versus a 3 to 5 minute presentation. Even assigning term papers or allowing for final exams that are essay method, it's difficult with this student to faculty ratio. Yet, we all know that in most cases, learning will improve with more labor intensive approaches. Having graduated in California, I often tease my students that I'm so old that I attended college for almost free. I attended community college and earned an AS degree and received a scholarship to complete my BA. The dream of obtaining an education that exceeded that of my parents became a reality. My father left school in 11th grade and was trained to be a tool and die engineer by Ford Motor Company. They even held his job for him while he served in World War II. My mother was first generation born in this country and grew up in an orphanage and escaped by joining the nursing corps. They had dreams of something more for their children. There are a lot of first-generation students like myself who make extraordinary sacrifices to obtain an education. Many of these students attend our smaller universities. They deserve the best that we as faculty can give and want to give. Unfortunately, over time, this funding model is making it impossible. As students exit the high school and seek a path toward higher education in Oregon, is the reality going to be dare to dream the impossible dream? I hope that within your support, it can become dream and achieve the dream. Because higher education is within your reach. Because Oregon supports a future of hope for all of its citizens. Thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Dr. Ayers. No questions? Yeah.
Well, I have one, but I'm not sure that we have time to cover it, but it's been one that I've been interested in asking for quite some time. Under the shared responsibility model, in both the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget, there's a very substantial investment of money. And I'm wondering if we could get some input, and I'm looking at Jay Kenton particularly, from the perspective of the university, if we are not funding the base budget for the operation of the university, where does that put you in terms of the value that the shared responsibility model has? I'm just curious about whether this is going to cause a big logjam as more students want to come into the system, but you don't have the availability to provide them with the classes that they need. And I'm wondering if you've done an analysis on that and if you have some quantitative answers for us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, for the record, I'm Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance for the Oregon University System, and I haven't actually analyzed that in detail. However, and I think I'll get into this a little bit tomorrow when I testify before this body, it is pretty clear that if we don't have the fundamental funding or basic funding in our budget, we may not have the capacity, and the shared responsibility model will probably stimulate demand, and that could create, as you know, a conundrum of sorts for ourselves to deal with. But I'd be happy to talk more about it tomorrow in the interest of time today.
If I might, Mr. Chair, the tuition piece of this from the university's perspective is something like 30% of the cost of a student. And so what do you anticipate happening if the number of students come into the system that the shared responsibility model models? And how are you going to deal with that on the co-chair's budget? That's the question that I'm interested in exploring.
I'd be happy to talk about that tomorrow.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I think it's a really important question. So. Are there any other? Senator Devlin.
I just had some questions about Professor Ayer's program, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Being probably somewhat similar in nature to the program at PSU, I would guess, the students would also be required probably to take a lot of courses in sociology, psychology, outside of straight administration and justice courses.
Actually, it's a criminology and criminal justice program now at Portland State University as well.
Okay.
We have 64 required courses that are within the area of criminology and criminal justice. Many years ago, it was required that sociology and psychology be met. However, today our focus is very much so on the area of forensic and forensic investigation, which differentiates us from Western's program or Portland's program.
Okay.
So they are more entrenched in the science and the criminal law aspect of prosecuting evidence through the system.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to understand the system at Southern Oregon. Obviously, we received a number of letters from faculty members and others at Southern Oregon. You have four full-time faculty members.
That's
how
correct.
Many part-time faculty members?
It depends on the term. Typically, we'll have one or two adjuncts on campus, but because of the size that we've taken our classrooms to, we've cut down on the number of adjuncts as well. Three of our faculty members are funded through the general fund. The fourth one is funded through our online program. So we have to make that salary. So we've been careful about the number of adjuncts we'll actually employ because of the fact that we're generating that revenue and hoping to keep full-time faculty and not just subsidizing the adjuncts through short-term employment.
Okay. And that's a very pressing question.
Follow up, sure.
I don't want to know what your personal salary is.
You really don't want to know.
It's probably about comparable to ours.
But have you had other offers?
Absolutely. In fact, I work part-time for Boston University. It subsidizes my income here so that I can remain and live in Southern Oregon. As a single parent, there'd be no other way to do it.
Representative Barnett?
I'm just wanting to follow up on the question. Did I hear you say that there are 64 required courses?
There are 64 credit hours. Each class is 4 credits. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if I may, that makes you one of the more demanding majors.
Actually, there's 110 hours required in chemistry, so we're average.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Things have changed since I was there.
Senator Morse.
It's been a few years for some of us.
Thank you. To follow up on the previous question with respect to the opportunity grants, if I may, my question would be, have we done an actuarial kind of analysis looking at the opportunity grants that we have provided in this biennium? As I understand it, they're undersubscribed to the tune of about $10 million. And then adding to that, looking forward, and looking at the students that would be availing themselves of that in the private colleges, in the universities, and in the public, and then looking at if those were fully utilized, would in fact we have the capacity, which the question was raised, to deal with those additional students in a way that allows them to matriculate in a normal cycle, whether it be 4 years or 5 years, depending on the program that they're in. And do we compound the problem if we bring students into a system that can't get them out in a timely way? So what have we accomplished by way of cost and assistance to those students? So my question, Mr. Chair, is, has that analysis been done? And if it is it something you can share with us so that we can make hopefully informed decisions about how we allocate these resources?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask the Chancellor to respond to this, if you don't mind.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, for the record, George Pernsteiner, Oregon University System. Thank you for the question. This points to the complexity that surrounded the way in which the State Board built its budget last year, in which it looked at a variety of factors, including affordability. And, in fact, it was the Board who originally proposed the shared responsibility model to the governor as part of an overarching view of how to better provide for Oregonians an opportunity to attend and complete college. It was coupled, as you know, with a proposed budget as well that led to the governor's recommended budget, which is before you. So they were viewed as two legs of three legs on a stool, the third leg being the growth of tuition at the rate of median family income. And the idea was that by providing tuition increases at no more than Oregon families could afford, by providing financial aid through the shared responsibility model at levels that therefore ensured that Oregonians could attend college, and then providing adequate resources to the universities and the community colleges to be able to serve them, that in fact the system would work as an integrated whole. The anticipation was, though, that the shared responsibility model would be effective in year two of the biennium, not in year one, and because there's a ramp-up time that's required, both in terms of putting the systems in place, which is going on right now, and also in terms of getting the word out to Oregon families that this now is an opportunity for them. So there was never an anticipation of an enrollment growth in year one due to the shared responsibility model. It was always expected to be in year two. At the time of the discussions that the board had, we decided that because the pickup rate in the current biennium on the opportunity grant was not as great as had been hoped, we would do two things. The first is we determined deliberately that we would not show enrollment growth due to shared responsibility model in this upcoming biennium. So the enrollment growth forecasts did not include that. And that was based on we don't know how long it's going to take for the word to get out there. The second thing that we did, though, at the request of the governor's office, is to try to come up with a model that would, in fact, get to the kinds of things you're talking about, that would kind of get to what can we expect in terms of enrollment at different levels of funding of the shared responsibility model. And in fact, that model has been developed, and I think Margie Lau was here, still is here, and she's now the person in the governor's office who understands that model the best. But it allows us then to make forecasts based on the very kinds of factors you're talking about. But I would hasten to add, the whole proposal is premised on providing all three of those pieces. One, the appropriation in the shared responsibility model to help make college affordable for Oregonians. Two, a restriction on tuition increases to the rate of growth in median family income so that Oregonians could continue to afford it. And three, adequate investment in the community colleges and universities to provide the access. And that's why the whole thing held together in the first place in the governor's recommended budget.
I'm really worried about time.
Okay. Can I just make a request?
Absolutely.
Ms. Prinsteiner, we get kind of
stretched between different presentations here. And like, in one sense, this question seemed like it would be better for the Student Assistance Commission, but actually, I think it's actually better for you in this case because it actually helps understand more in terms of what the actual impact is. I can understand the reason financially and otherwise, the need to inform students of the changes to have it start in the second year. My understanding is with that model that the way that you could control costs would be to reduce the income levels that would be eligible for the model, in the sense that where the way the model's constructed, students with significantly more assets than in the past, or families, would be able to avail themselves of opportunity grants. We had a cutoff under the existing, we have an existing cutoff that's relatively low, and once you get past that, you get nothing, basically. And I assume that most of the cost is going to be for the students most in need. But have you done any analysis if we adjust some of those? If we get into a situation, it's always good if you don't have to choose between A, B, and C, but many times we have to choose between A, B, and C. If there's, have you done some analysis of what adjustments can be made to that model to bring down the cost in the second year, and could you share those with the committee? Not today.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, again, the Access and Affordability Working Group did look at all of those kinds of things as it was developing the model, and came to the proposal that it had largely because it was what was needed to ensure affordability. I think Ms. Lau can tell me. Yeah, apparently we can model
Mr.
all kinds
Chancellor,
of things.
Mr. Chancellor, everybody that appears before any subcommittee that I'm on says that the appropriation is needed to meet the need. That isn't the question. The question is the dollars that are available. Can you share with us some analysis on that in terms of ways it might be adjusted? The other issue that we have, and Mr. Bender maybe has resolved it, but he brought it to us.
It's a heck of a request.
We have a number that's in the governor's budget, which actually is in the co-chair's budget, too. But we don't know if we can actually keep the same promise we kept with the opportunity grant, that everybody that comes in and applies will get one, because we're not as comfortable with it, that being the absolute cost of this in the first year. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
At the levels of awards that the governor proposed from the Access and Affordability Working Group. We also, Senator, in the RFO are able to look at modifications of the award structure under the opportunity grant, and we'd be happy to assist you if you want to look at alternatives. And I'd like to hear from both the Board of Higher Education and the Chancellor's Office on that too.
Very good. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we're adjourned.